This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Parents today are more able to explore their children's genetic makeup than ever before. But this information about your child's DNA, is it empowering or does it create more anxiety about possible genetic defects? In her new book, writer Bonnie Rockman explores the pros and cons of modern genetic testing in children. The book is called The Gene Machine, How Genetic Technologies Are Changing the Way We Have Kids and the Kids We Have. Bonnie reads Sunday at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, but first she joins me on the program. Bonnie Rockman, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. The theme throughout this book looks at sort of our access to technology and, frankly, how it's outpaced our understanding of genetic disease. And this is rooted in a personal experience of yours. You were pregnant with your third child in 2007. Tell us about that experience and what you found and perhaps how that led to this book.
Sure. So I, as you say, I was pregnant with my third, my daughter, Orly, and I went in for a routine ultrasound in the second trimester. And the tech found what's called a choroid plexus cyst, which is essentially a cyst on her brain. And as you might imagine, that sounded absolutely terrifying. And so I was told that it could be a marker for trisomy 18, which is a very severe, often fatal before or shortly after birth condition that involves three copies of chromosome 18 instead of the standard two. So I was told, you know, okay, you can just relax, watch and wait, see what happens, or you can get an amniocentesis, so essentially a needle in the belly to extract some fetal DNA and analyze that. And so I said, I need that amnio. Let's get it right now. And fortunately, all the results were fine. She didn't have trisomy 18. But because I'm a reporter, I had, and I think also because I'm the daughter of a doctor, I knew to ask the lab to please just send me the lab report. And, you know, they usually send it to your doctor, but I wanted to get a copy of it just for my records. And when it came in the mail a few days later, I was living in Raleigh at the time, I was really stunned to see that, as I said, thank goodness she did not have trisomy 18, but she did have something unusual called inversion 9, which means that her ninth chromosome was flipped. So the bottom, all the DNA was there. It wasn't like she was missing anything, which was reassuring. But what was supposed to be on the top was on the bottom, and what was supposed to be on the bottom was on the top. And so, of course, I did exactly what you shouldn't do. I went straight to Google and started typing in inversion 9. And found all these terrifying things. But really, in truth, that inversion 9 is not known to have any kind of significant, any sort of clinical implications really whatsoever. But knowing about it kind of freaked me out until I sort of assimilated that and realized that as I started looking into this more, everyone has different genetic mutations. And I think that that is something that most people don't understand.
Right. So this gets us to a little knowledge is a bad thing, right? And the fact that there is so much out there and so much we have access to, but then not the full base to understand, you know, kind of the context in which this is taken. So what, and that's an important thing because we don't know to what extent, you know, a chromosome 9 inversion was commonplace before we could even diagnose it, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, we were told, my husband and I were told at the time that it's very likely that one of us has this same inversion and we passed it along to our daughter. But because we didn't have this sort of testing before we were born, when we were in utero, we don't know if we have this. You know, we're reaching a point now where genetic testing is becoming increasingly incorporated, certainly into prenatal care, but into healthcare in general. And as that continues, more and more people are going to come face to face with results that A, they're not anticipating, or B, in some cases, they actually find pretty unclear.
All right. Well, let's talk about a case where it could have been more serious. You talk about it in your book when you were pregnant with your first child in 2002. You went to the doctor because you wanted a certain test. You're an Ashkenazi Jew, and you knew that that held certain risks for genetic disease, and you wanted your doctor to test you for that. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's something that most Jews of Eastern European descent know, that they're at greater risk for a certain number of Jewish genetic diseases. So when I was pregnant with my first, I went to my OBGYN and I waltzed in there and said, "Hi, I'm newly pregnant. What diseases do I need to be tested for?" So that was really my first mistake right there. And this is sort of a PSA. People should not wait until women should not wait until they're pregnant to get what's known as carrier screening, which can detect whether you and your partner are a carrier for the same genetic disease. And you don't need to be Jewish to be at increased risk of passing on this disease. Jews are at increased risk for passing on certain of these genetic diseases, but everyone really, every ethnicity, every population is at risk. And so ideally, you would do this before you're ever even pregnant so that you have more options and you can really take more control of the situation. Nevertheless, what did I know? So I was tested during pregnancy, and I was told I only needed to be screened for one disease called Tay-Sachs disease. And I, it was kind of this very uncomfortable situation because I felt, as a result of my research, that I actually knew more than my doctor. So I said to him, "Actually, I've done a little research, and there are some Jewish genetic disease centers in New York City that advocate testing for, at the time, it was about 9 diseases." And he looked at me like I was a hypochondriac and said, "Oh, you don't need that. Don't worry about that." And so I proceeded to find another OB and also to locate a genetic counselor at a nearby hospital. And she, I think she was bemused, frustrated, and kind of laughed when I told her the story because it's so common. And there's a real lack of knowledge across the board about who should be screened for what genetic diseases and how much is too much. And, you know, genetics is really not, it's not taught in medical school to a great degree. I sat in on, I live in Seattle now, and I sat in on a kind of a genetics 101 med school class here at the University of Washington. And that's all these med school students get, unless, of course, they decide to specialize in genetics. It's just one course. And so, you know, again, as genetics is becoming increasingly prevalent and incorporated into our healthcare, it's not enough to just get this kind of cursory overview.
Then the question, too, is, and that story, it seems to me, opens up a lot of questions. I mean, the first is, what if you found that you were at higher risk for Tay-Sachs? Then what does a parent do with that kind of information? And again, that's one question, but there are a number of other genetic tests that can produce a result that leave parents in a quandary because there's, you know, in terms of what options, what do we do about this new information?
Well, so I'll tackle your first question first. So the reason that you want to know before you're pregnant, ideally, about your risk for passing on a genetic disease is because there are actually some pretty amazing options that are available now. So there's something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which involves creating embryos through IVF. So just as any couple who would go through assisted reproduction would do. So, you know, eggs and sperm in a petri dish, and you then look at these, you look at these embryos that have been created, and you select the ones that don't have the particular genetic mutation that you are trying to avoid. So it's very, very different from gene editing, which has been in the news a lot lately, because back in February, there were some very eminent panels of scientists on a federal level that that said, for the very first time, we actually think in very specific situations, it might be okay to edit egg, sperm, or embryos. And that's actually changing the egg, sperm, or embryos. But with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, all you're doing is just saying, okay, we have a dozen embryos and five of them have this mutation, so we're not going to implant, we're not going to transfer those embryos into the expectant mom's uterus. We're just going to set those aside.
And in that process, yeah, you talked about embryos being created. These are the mom's embryos. We're not, they're not being created in the lab or brought from another place, right? These are mom's embryos. And you're,
well,
just...
they are. I mean, the way you do in vitro fertilization, it is in a laboratory. So, you know, dad's sperm, mom's eggs, or donor sperm or eggs. But yes, and then you're simply looking at them. You're not changing anything. You're not adding anything. You're not taking away anything. You're just saying, oh, look at that. This particular embryo has this genetic mutation, and this embryo would go on to develop into a fetus and a baby that has Tay-Sachs disease. And Tay-Sachs disease is fatal, typically before kindergarten, and it's an absolutely terrible disease. And so we are certainly not going to implant this embryo. So it's a way to halt the transmission to you know, if you have this genetic legacy in your history, it's a way to kind of stop that train and say, okay, this is going to go no further. We're not going to pass on this particular mutation.
And as you say, this is different than gene editing in that we're not going to tamper with anything we find. We're just going to try to find something that has a less likelihood of passing this on. It does raise the question, though, of responsibility, because once you take control of this process or greater control, then there's a kind of liability question. What if something does happen? To what degree are you, is the lab or someone else, the medical practitioner, more responsible for what did happen?
Well, I see what you're saying. And throughout healthcare, there are errors and mistakes that occur all the time. I mean, this is not done by all this medical technology and all these amazing advances. They're not being performed by robots. They're being performed by humans. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, there's human error. But I personally think that the ability to be able to avoid this harrowing and fatal disease in childhood, to me, that's a no-brainer. Now, it gets incredibly more complicated when you think about using that technology to eliminate a genetic mutation that might increase risk for a disease decades down the road. And that's something I go into in my book, because while it's not very controversial to use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to avoid Tay-Sachs disease, for example, it is hugely more controversial to use it to select an embryo that doesn't have a BRCA, a breast cancer mutation. Because when you have these mutations, which really got a lot of media attention several years ago when Angelina Jolie went public with the fact that she has a BRCA mutation is at increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer. And then, you know, she had her ovaries out and she had a prophylactic mastectomy, and she wrote about all that and made it public to try and increase awareness. But so if you create embryos and you do choose not to implant the ones that have that BRCA mutation, a lot of people think that that is akin to playing God.
But does it create more problems down the line? I mean, the first question is, do you have the right to do this? And that becomes kind of a moral, ethical question in and of its own right. Are there dangers that you're creating the possibility of different kinds of mutations, or again, the law of unintended consequences? You can't write about all of them because you don't know. But do they create problems down the line because you've eliminated this, you know, up the line, generations from now? Are we going to see consequences that we will regret?
Well, so that would not happen with something like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, because again, you're not changing or adding or taking away. You're not actually doing anything to the embryo. It's almost like, imagine a batch of cookies and you have to decide which of them you want to eat. And you're going to pick the biggest ones with the most chocolate chips. So the ones that don't get eaten, nothing is happening to them, nor is anything happening to the cookies that you've chosen. Those are just simply the ones that you have selected. But you're absolutely right that there is so much that we don't know when it comes to tinkering with embryos or with eggs or with sperm. So you know, that is real. That's very much in a research, very, very early stage sort of situation now. And what is happening more commonly is that gene editing is being used in people. So not in not in embryos, but in people who are already in this world and are sick. And so gene editing is being used for therapeutic purposes to try and treat diseases. And so then the question becomes, let's say that we are successful at treating a disease in, say, a 30-year-old person. And then if you take it to the next step, you say, okay, well, let's try and use that technology and apply it to an embryo who will develop that same disease a couple decades down the line, and let's try and prevent that disease in an embryo. So while that is would be an incredible, amazing medical accomplishment, and of course, amazing for that particular family, what we don't know currently is what removing genes or you know, smoothing things over. We don't know exactly if that will give rise to other problems.
Right.
So that's the concern.
That's the kind of biological or environmental question. What are we releasing downstream when we do this today without knowing the full consequences? Then the ethical questions, too. Again, you can see how gene editing is going to be used to wipe out horrible diseases, but eventually it becomes a class question. People with a lot of money can design the child they want. This is inevitable, and it becomes a serious ethical question that I know that we're facing in talking about today, and you write about in your book.
Absolutely. So I feel like it is sort of writ large what already exists in our society in terms of healthcare. So when you think about who has access to great healthcare now, it's people who have money. So this is already occurring. It's not like it's something new that we are introducing. And I'm not saying it's fair, but what I'm doing is just pointing out that this inequity already exists, and genetic technology is able to exacerbate that. Even when you think about people who have couples who struggle to have babies, and they decide to turn to IVF, which is incredibly common nowadays. Who can afford to do that? So, you know, in North Carolina, insurers are not required to cover IVF as they are in several other states. Now, most states don't cover it, but for example, Massachusetts does require health insurers to cover it. But if you live in a state where it's not covered, well, you have to be able to cobble together thousands and thousands of dollars to try to have a baby. So it's going to be the same thing with trying to improve that baby. Oh, it's certainly not going to be covered by insurance. So it's only going to be people of means who are able to do that. And that is just going to, I think, to widen the gap between haves and have-nots.
You know, I've only given you about a minute for this, but I'm going to try to do it anyway, because there is some promise in knowing what you have and what to do with the diagnosis. There's the story of Kara Green and how gene sequencing helped her and her family. Maybe you can give us the brief summary.
Absolutely. I'll be really quick. So genome sequencing is reading, decoding essentially all 20,000 something of your genes. And it can be extremely controversial in some situations, in some uses. But where it's not controversial is to try and diagnose mysterious disease. And that happened in the case of Kara Green, whose family used to live in Raleigh and now lives in Wilmington. So it was assumed that she had an autoimmune disease that was making her just deteriorate. Her parents were kind of watching her lose her abilities right before their eyes. And she went to Duke, an incredible geneticist, Dr. Vanda Nishashi, persuaded the parents to have Kara's genome sequenced. And they were able to figure out that she had an extremely a genetic mutation that was incredibly rare. She was one of just a handful of people in the world who had been diagnosed with something called Brown-Violetto-Vandler syndrome. And the amazing thing is that in this situation, she was able to be treated with mega doses of a B vitamin. And she is just improving just to an incredible degree. So that, you know, that's kind of an outlier case. That does not always happen, where genome sequencing can crack you know, can crack a medical mystery. But when it does, that is sort of like that is the pinnacle of its use.
And if it's used well and if everybody has access. Bonnie Rockman
exactly.
is the author of The Gene Machine, How Genetic Technologies Are Changing the Way We Have Kids and Kids Have Us, reading Sunday afternoon at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thank you, Frank.
Coming up, a preview of a performance that honors a group of imprisoned Jewish singers. We'll hear about it on The State of Things. Stay tuned.